Wheeler. Now, some of you may have heard of Kip Thorne or like John Wheeler. We know, sadly, that John Wheeler died earlier this year. Kip Thorne is still going. But I kind of show you to show you that this is going back going back a decade or two. This was our little rule book on how to figure these things out. And this book's pretty old. You can probably find chapters of this on the internet. All right? And anybody who spends some time dealing with gravity and general relativity just has this on the bookshelf because it looks so cool. You can spend some money. You might as well get a thick book, right? So it's really cool. All right. Prior to this, a couple of days ago, if you can recall, I introduced this concept of gravity, this general relativity, and introduced it as was mentioned with this hot plate. But there were two primary concepts I wanted to get out of it. And one was this excess radius. There's some extra curvature that was required when doing measurements. And the other thing was this property of an object moving in gravity had to move in such a way that it experienced the longest possible time. And those are the two balances that went across that. Now, we had an equation, if you can remember, the 1/3 gm over c squared, which is basically the simplified version of Einstein's field equations. And I'll show you what the field equations really look like in this talk. So I want you to sit back, enjoy where we're going. I'm going to give you a history. Because I think, as Lee Smolin had said earlier on in your first keynote lecture, to understand where we're going, you need to understand the people involved. Because you're going to be continuing that journey. And you would like part of your history, the ups and the downs, incorporated in why you went the direction that you went. And so this is the beginning of the journey. So we're going to talk about black holes. And of course, we need to define what a black hole is. It's a great, enormous thing like nothing, a huge, big well, like, I don't know, like an enormous nothing. I think that's probably the best definition of a black hole that I've ever encountered. Right? And you'll see why by the time we get to the end of the talk, right, you'll understand that that statement really says everything. Now, we're going to take a bit of a history back. 1783, John Mitchell, this was somebody which we call a natural philosopher. This is what it was to be a scientist back then. You studied everything. You were a doctor, you were a lawyer, you were a philosopher. You were an architect, you were a dentist. You did astrology on the side. You were a natural philosopher. And what John Mitchell did, he played with what was known about light from Newton's time. He understood that light was like a particle. And if it was like a particle, like a little ball, he figured that when I throw a ball in the air, it comes back down. And he just reasoned very logically. He says, well, what would happen if I increase the mass of the Earth, or the object I'm dealing with? Then it would mean for me to throw the ball, I'd have to throw it a lot harder, a lot faster to get it going up. And he made this nice little fun hypothetical leap. He says, what would happen if I made the Earth either so dense, so massive, such that if I threw a light photon upwards, it would go up and come back down. What would I see from the outside? And he logically says, well, if I'm on the outside and my buddy is throwing these light particles upwards, I should see nothing because the light is not making it off the planet. And therefore, you would have what he would call a dark star. Okay? Only using Newton's laws. Something that I just want to emphasize, this little point right here. It says, if you could fly close enough to this dark star and look around, you could still define the features of the object. He allowed you to actually go in and around these light particles that were on the way up. So he allowed you to explore the environment where the mass is very, very intense. And then all of a sudden, about 1803, Thomas Young did this nice little experiment and showed light was a wave, and this whole thing went bye-bye. Lost interest. But so it was just a little scribble note in the history of black holes. It was very interesting because the technique he used was just balancing these two things here, right? And if you plug in your numbers, we can actually just figure out what the escape velocity. Wouldn't it be nice if math was done this way? So he figured out by looking at what the escape velocity in the Earth, he says, oh, if you use this technique and you travel at 11.2 kilometers per second, you've hit this thing called escape velocity and you can leave the Earth's surface. And then, of course, he says, well, what would happen if I want to make the escape velocity 3 times 10 to the 8? What radius? How small would I have to compact the Earth in to figure out the size of the Earth that would make the escape velocity the speed of light? So if you plug in all your numbers, again, this is how John Mitchell designed it. It came out to about 9 millimeters. I tried that, Richard. Be my guest. We had tried that, but it kept turning itself off, so we were confused. But you've got the touch. So, using John Mitchell's technique, and just basically using Newton's laws, we figured out, as John Mitchell, that if the Earth, all the mass of the Earth was compacted to a radius of about 9 millimeters, this little light photon could not leave the surface and come right back down. Okay. Just make a mental note of that number. Okay. Now, we've kind of talked about this equivalence principle, but sometimes seeing a picture is the best. So let's kind of just run this little clip here. We're just going to take an elevator ride with a guest of ours. Oops. So you can imagine if the elevator did fall, he's not worried too much. Because it would be exactly the same if he was in a rocket ship, just floating around in space. If the engines are turned on, the bottom of the rocket ship with his feet would stabilize himself. Check out, yeah, looks good. Just as if he was on an elevator. So this is the principle of equivalence we've been talking about, right? The accelerated frame is equivalent to being on a planet with an acceleration. Right? That's why you hear sometimes your physics teacher talk about the acceleration due to gravity. Einstein says, if you have no windows in your rocket ship, there is no experiment locally that you could do to determine if you were actually sitting on the rocket ship in space or if the rocket ship was falling. So, right? Now, Let's have a look at some fun numbers to keep some of you happy. In the 1900s, and you remember that in 1905, Einstein was producing papers left, right, and center. And when he started working on his general relativity, it took him about 10 years to kick this thing out. And as we've talked about before, we've discovered that it's this bending of space-time, right? Space and time, if you want to think of it that way, which is what really gets bent and creates all the effects that we've discovered. Now, those of you may have heard Einstein's field equations. How many people have heard the word field equation, Einstein's field equations? Right? Well, there it is right there. Nice little version of it. And it looks so simple. You know, it's even easier than, you know, F equals GMM over R squared, right? This just got some nice little symbols inside there. And in fact, this one is a bit more complicated because it's got a couple of parts. First of all, it's got this this G and a couple of Greek letters, and we knew, but everybody looks at them and says, isn't that UV? But we'll go with that. We've got this guy right here that tells us about the geometry, the curving of space-time. Then we have this other little piece. You may have heard of it, the cosmological constant. So you've seen that symbol before. This is the correction factor that Albert inserted into his equations just to make it match what the current model of the universe looked like. And then there's an 8 pi, which is wonderful. If you think about it, pi is incorporated into the universe. And then you have this T, with again the mu nu's on that side. And this tells me everything about matter and momentum and motion. And so we have these things, by the way, are called tensors. You've heard Richard kind of introduce that word. So we have something on one side, a stress energy tensor, and we have an Einsteinian tensor on the other side. And we'll kind of talk about tensors as we move on a bit. I'm not going to blow you out of the water with the mathematics of tensors, but it's kind of nice to get a feeling of what these things are. Well, the first thing that Einstein did is once Hubble tapped him on the shoulder, is he realized that it can probably be written this way. I don't need this cosmological constant anymore because the universe is changing and is expanding through Hubble's work. And so this one simple equation, okay, sets aside exactly what GR is all about, general relativity. Now, just to take it up a notch, so there's our nice little equation. You can impress your friends with these nice little words, a coupled elliptic hyperbolic nonlinear partial differential equation for metric components, right? Great phrase. But what is this all saying? Coupled. Multiple terms. The equations themselves cannot be solved individually. So we have a curvature that is neither positive nor negative, but never zero. So it's either one way or the other. And you can think about it elliptic hyperbolic, because Richard had kind of drawn some of those drawings on this closed versus open type of geometry for you. Nonlinear, hopefully that one shouldn't be too difficult. And then you may have heard of derivatives, but these are basically partial derivatives. And when you do a bit of calculus, that will make a bit more sense to you. But again, what's this all saying? This is saying, there we go, that we have to take a bit of a step back. Okay. Now, I like to thank Richard because some of these things I borrowed from Richard. They'll look familiar. This is going back probably almost 7-8 years ago. So, but this is kind of neat because I can go through this fast because Richard has taught you all about special relativity. So we can do this very, 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 very quickly. So space-time diagram, there's Bob, there's Alice, and there's Alice's twin sister, Alice. Right, so distance between Alice is 10 meters. We have the ticking of the clock. Bob moves across. How do we draw that using a space-time diagram? Right. Question is also how much time has Bob elapsed for Bob? And like I said, you guys are really good at doing this, so we can kick through this very, very quickly. We draw some nice little space-time diagrams. There we go. There's Alice and Alice prime at rest. Let's kick up Bob, have Bob do his thing. Bob, you're going to be going that way, but really time moves upwards, so the direction is really this way. Let's collect the line, and you've had a lot of practice doing these things. Nice little calculation, 2 meters per second. That's normally we go through these things, so I'm going to do very quickly. Bob at rest, but at Alice tossing up a baseball, Bob moving fast, Bob moving slow, the Earth orbiting the Sun. You've done all of these, so we can run through these things very, very quickly. Bob at rest, not too exciting. There they are. Alice tossing a baseball up. That's what the space-time diagram would look like. Kind of matches it. Kind of nice with a bit of animation. Makes it kind of make a bit of sense. Bob moving fast, Bob moving slow. And then I know you did this one for one of the homework questions. The Earth orbiting the Sun. Simple as that. Now, let's kick fast back to how do we indicate the ticking? So again, Richard has done a lot of this, so I can go through this part very, very quickly. Newton's assumption is this universal time. And what happens to this universal time when Bob is traveling at different speeds, i.e. he's going fast and slow. Does universal time work for special relativity? And hopefully you discovered that the answer to this is no. And the question is, what does our actual data show? And we've found that the faster you move, the longer the time clicks. And very simply, you look at how can we connect the dots. Right? And that's exactly what Richard did. He determined how do you connect the dots when you did your space-time diagrams. So you've got Alice's dots, slow Bob dots, and then fast Bob dots. How do you connect those dots? And you kind of notice that the lines, like, seem to want to bend upwards, right? The one, the one, the two, two, they kind of have to line up this way. So you need some sort of way of getting our diagram to match what we see from our data. And you try different ideas. There's our buddy again. So the first thing you may want to sit there and say, okay, I'll try and transfer, use circles to transfer the 1 second, the 2 second, 3 second. And if you do that, you should notice something very interesting. That when you try to do the circle, the four didn't quite match. Right? It was actually, we're bending the wrong way. You think about this. So we do our circles. Our points are not quite, we remember we wanted everything to bend up rather than bend down. But trying to determine and think about it in terms of a circle was a great task. we had 4, this is 4.2, but we actually is below that, not here, so we needed it to bend up. And the best way to make it bend up was to take one little sign, right, because you remember it had to bend up, take the one little sign and change it from a positive to a negative. And that was a nice little change. And when we have that, we created a geometry of hyperbolas. Right? And that's exactly what you did as part of the homework questions that you're working on. Now, the nice thing about this is we can put the minus sign here or put the minus sign there. It doesn't matter which term that we'd like to choose here, but we've got this nice looking geometry made out of hyperbolas. And this is the Minkowski space that you've been dealing with. So this is special relativity done very, very quickly. So we'll just take that out. And you'll say, well, what does that, why is that important to us? It gives us, number one, a speed limit. And if you took the hyperbolas and you remember they became asymptotic to those two diagonals. And if I take those two diagonals and I rotate them around, I create this thing called a cone. And some of you may have heard this term, the light cone, as part of your reading, and that's exactly what that is. So we need a technique for handling this. So I said we need to create a mathematical tool that can handle both space and time. So rather than just having x and y or x, y, and z, we need an extra little location to hold like time variable, a t component. And this is, by the way, this is where if you're doing some reading and some of the textbooks talk about time being in the fourth dimension, this is what they're implying, that it requires 4 pieces of data. 4 elements, rather than 2 elements or 3 elements, but 4 elements to indicate an event that happens in space-time. Now, you're probably more familiar with this. This is your basic Pythagorean theorem. And I've just rewritten it in terms of polar coordinates. Now, polar coordinates are very similar. It gets us the same result. So if I'm looking back here and I see Mark sitting back there watching the lecture, I can refer to Mark by using the Pythagorean triangle. So if I've got an x and y coordinate system, I can then use Pythagoras to determine exactly how far he is away from me. But I have another technique. I can actually pick an orientation and I can say, I can define where Mark is by saying what angle, based on my initial orientation, and then how far along to go along that angle. And that's basically what the polar coordinate's going to look like. So don't be afraid of this, but you notice it still takes basically two pieces of data, an R and an angle, just like an X and Y, to get me to my location here. Okay. The only thing that's kind of neat is I'm going to take one of these terms and I'm going to make it negative. Okay? Positive, positive. I'll just take one of them and make it negative. Okay? And this is the heart of the Minkowski space. Now, as Einstein discovered, basically as he's working through his theory, he needed to do some little modifications. And one of the modifications is a term called a geodesic. Okay? And we kind of talked about that, right? It moves along curve shortest distance in space-time. That's another force acts on it. Okay? This is the flight path that a jet flies when you're flying from, let's say, Toronto to London, England. It will follow the shortest path. And the neat thing to notice that, right, is that these geodesics are going to be, for us, going to be the natural curve, natural movement that a particle is going to fall within a gravitational field. Nice little animation showing us in our little plane. There you go. Well, just for you, right? Yeah. But it's kind of neat. See, the plane didn't have to turn. It's following a straight line. It just happens to be that the Earth curves underneath, and that actually becomes the shortest, the distance between Toronto and Rome. Now, in reality, you notice here, I'm telling you that they're very difficult to calculate. It's like looking at a very complicated, lumpy landscape with hills and valleys. How does one calculate the shortest distance from one point to the other when the terrain is full of all these hills and bumps? And we're lazy. So if we're lazy, we want to come up with different ways to do it. But you have to remember, when Einstein came up with this idea, he had to do it in space-time, so he had to do it with four dimensions. So we had these lumps and hills and bumps happening with four dimensions. The technique's kind of neat. If you kind of look at it from above, the lumps kind of disappear, right? It flattens itself out. Now, if it flattens itself out, I then need some new type of mathematical tools that helps me convert this flattened out hill, right, which is very easy to do calculations on, to one that actually has all these lumps and bumps. And the tool that we're going to use is called the metric of the space. And you, if you're doing some reading, you'll notice that it's indicated by usually a tiny lowercase g. So when you hear people talking about metrics, right, and you'll hear it in different disciplines, they're basically using it a way of measuring something. And we're going to be using it as a tool to measure something in space-time, some sort of a distance in space-time, that allows us to handle all these lumps and bumps and things like that without getting lost in the math. So, simply, it's a way of converting distances from a flat space into a curved space. There we go. So Albert's going to do some more talking, and he's going to talk a bit about a taximeter. It says it's like a taximeter which converts a fixed amount of time and distance into a cost for the passenger. That's what a taximeter does when you get into a taxi. And you basically want to note that at different locations or at different times, it's going to cost you differently in the taxi cab. So in Waterloo, to go a certain distance may cost you, let's say, $10. But if you're in New York City to go the same distance, it may cost you a lot more. Or at different times of the day, it may cost you more because the rates will change. Okay. So the taxi metric depends on the time, but it can also depend on the location that you are. Okay. Just, again, all I'm trying to do is get you a gut feel about these terms that you may encounter as you're reading, plus to give you a true feeling about what poor Albert had to do. Now, it's not a single number. Okay. If it was a single number, right, it could tell us. It wouldn't be able to tell us something very, very important. So it has the metric has to hold enough information to allow us to discern the geometry that we're dealing with. And if you notice on a sphere, it kind of curves in two directions, right? East, west, north, south. But we also talked about this, right? That the cylinder really only curves in one direction. They both curve, and this difference allowed me to introduce those two terms, right? The intrinsic and extrinsic curvature. But we still needed two numbers to specify the curvature of the surface of the sphere that we need to. We know it curves in left and right, up and down, that is east, west, north, and south. And if we're trying to do it in four dimensions, you would sit there and say, well, two dimensions, three dimensions, two, what about four dimensions? And the nice, exciting thing about the mathematics, it works out that to keep track of everything that's curving in every direction, in every combination of the direction, with time being one of them, it requires 10 pieces of information. Now, with 10 pieces of information, I need another set of mathematics to keep track of this. So what started happening, it started to get more and more complex. So there are mathematical tools that are required to help keep track of what's happening. And that's the role of the tensor. So it's an organized tool. It's going to look very, very similar for us to a matrix. But all it's going to do, it's going to have an index, and it's just going to tell us what's inside. It's like a container that's going to help us keep track of what's happening, specifically in space-time. Okay? Now, a zero tensor is equivalent to like a scalar, like a number. And you'll notice those of you who have some vectors will realize there's a similar overlap here. A one tensor is a string, and that for our case, four numbers, right? Each of those numbers means something. A two tensor would be for us in space-time a set of 4 by 4, which creates a set of 16 numbers. Okay? So it's like a matrix that holds this information. So he's got these strange little tools. He's got this metric. He's got these tensors. He's got this curvature. What does it look like when he starts putting it all together? This is what it looks like. Again, I've tossed this stuff in here just for those of you who like to take the gravitational constant. This is what Einstein's field equation looks like expanded out a bit more. Oh, each one of those colors means something. Okay, so it's part of what we call the stress energy tensor, right? And different colors, different lines tell us, does it hold momentum? Does it hold pressure? Each row has, you saw, I forgot who it was, it must have done 3 lowercase p plus another p for pressure, and when he's talking about how the inflation, you might, perfect example. We talk about what makes the universe expand, this accelerated universe that we're discovering. That lies in this purple line here, because you can have such a thing as negative pressure. That is the component. What these numbers do, right? These numbers all deal with the energy. They have to hold the information about space. How fast it's moving is this object that we're dealing with. So if you're trying to define the geometry of space-time around in this room, we need to know the density, we need to know the pressure, we need to know how much you weigh, what is the density at you at a specific location. All the stuff of the energy content that makes you has to be encoded inside this geometry. Right? And then this basically gives us the curvature. And this curvature itself is written in terms of another set of a tensor called a Ricci tensor, which gets bigger and bigger and bigger. So what I'm trying to show is this one little equation is really this huge set of things dealing with tensors, which hold the information of the structure of the space that we're dealing with. So what Einstein did was the easy stuff. He says, here's the rule. Go ahead and figure this thing out, solve it. Because I'm telling you that the left side has to go right side. You put stuff on the left side, make it equal to the right side. And if you do this, you can define the structure. And you can see the 16 equations in the form. We have a lot of duplicates. Don't need to worry about that. But I'm just going to show you, here's a partial solution. Just a partial solution. Okay. This is just in two dimensions. Not four, just two. This is just the Ricci part that goes for part of the Einstein time. Richard does this in his sleep. We pay homage to a company called IBM or HP, right? Because these computers can solve these things for us a lot better than we can. Now, could you imagine trying to do this? Nobody has solved these things. All we can do is take Einstein's set of rules, these field equations, and look at restricted parameters and see how we can understand it. Restricted parameters. And you'll see, with that in mind, how we put together the story of black holes. I am leading to black holes. Yeah. So what does all those numbers and everything like that, what does it really say? It's telling us that mass tells space how to curve. And a curved space will tell a mass how to move. Remember, the mass is following that shortest distance. It's considered a straight line, right? It's just following that. It doesn't know anything about curve. It's got its eyes on the road and going straight. It doesn't know that it's actually curving. It's this that manifests itself into the gravity that we know and love. Now, I just want to just kind of show you. It's an old set of pictures, but in the early 90s, it really meant something. This here is a massive object, has some high level of mass. All the calculations done on this picture were done using, in those days, it was a Hewlett-Packard mini computer. And it was able to kick out this diagram with these objects, with water underneath, using just Newtonian laws. And it was able to kick out this diagram and produce this picture. And it was able to do it in, I think it was about 5 minutes processing time back then. And the question says, well, what happens if we take the same picture, the same rules now, the same mass, but we actually apply Einsteinian mechanics, the general relativity. So all Newton says is the water is just bent up to meet the massive soccer ball. Okay? If I run the same thing through general relativity, it took, I believe it was 5 days of processing power by this HP machine to kick out this diagram. Now, there's a lot of stuff happening in here, okay? But more than just the water rising up to meet the soccer ball, you'll notice that you're actually seeing the back end of the soccer ball. You're actually seeing the sky being on the top and the sky being on the bottom. You're seeing like you're looking right through that beam that was off on the side. This whole distortion that happens has to be calculated in what we call ray trace backwards to try to determine this process. So just want to demonstrate that there is, when you start talking about large masses, there is a difference between Newton and general relativity when we deal with very, very large masses. So Einstein produces his paper, right? And in, like anything else, I think this one actually runs, like anything else, it needs to be verified. So how do you verify this extraordinary piece of work? Well, you need to do some sort of an experiment. And the only thing that you have is the sun. That's the largest massive object that we have around us. And so Arthur Eddington, smart guy. If you got a sir, you probably have to be smart. So if you could imagine, we're in around World War I, and everybody's going to war, and you could probably go to the powers that be, the ministers of defense, and say, you know what, I have an idea. I've heard of this theory, this general theory of relativity by this little patent clerk, Albert Einstein, and it would be very beneficial for England to understand if the rules of gravity are different, because if they're wrong and we can improve it, we can produce better weapons. But I'm a lover, not a fighter. So I don't want to go to war. But what I'll do is I'll go and I will prove that this Einstein's equation is either true or false, and we'll know which direction to go into. So he got himself a nice little cruise, and as you can see, he just headed off towards Africa. And he recognized an interesting phenomenon. As you saw in the little bit of an animation that was over here, which I ran, general relativity says that light will follow its shortest path. So if you get something very, very massive in between the light's natural path from its source to the Earth, then the light would probably curve around that path. Now, our eyes wouldn't understand it curved, and we would think that the light was at a different location, this little bending. So the process is very easy. If I could somehow know where a star was supposed to be, place the sun very, very close to that star, the starlight would then bend, would warp around the sun. My eye would see the new direction of the starlight, and it would appear to be a bit to the left or a bit to the right of that star. That was the logic behind it. Now, the bummer about that is at nighttime, the sun's not up. So I can see the stars, but I can't see the sun. So we needed an event which allowed me to see this star, the sun, but the sun had to be blacked out so I could still see the effects and still see the star. So it was a solar eclipse, 1919. Now, here's the picture. Now, there are quite a few purists that recognize the errors in here that were close enough that could take it either way, but this was the picture that convinced Eddington that this is the direction he was going to go, right? And where it should be, where the star was, and you can see the difference that took place in here. It was this discovery which immediately went to this telegram, which immediately went to all the papers around the world, which immediately made headlines, that this guy named Einstein has a new theory of gravity. Probably didn't make very many physicists very happy at the time, because they'd have to go back and learn all the math that Einstein had to do. Now, we've done some testing. One of the first tests that was done, it's a favorite of mine, was done in 1976. One of the nice little Viking 1 missions. And one of the mandates as part of its testing platform was it knew that at some point when it was sitting on Mars, that the Earth and Mars, as you can see, the line of sight was very, very close to the sun. And when it was very, very close to the sun, they're going to send a signal. And if this signal followed its natural path, and if Einstein was, again, correct, it should curve, travel an extra amount. And as you can see, And by the way, this instrumentation was very accurate. It traveled about 37 kilometers, plus and minus, they were so accurate, plus and minus actually 37 meters. This is how confident they are in this data. 37 kilometers, plus and minus 37 meters. And in fact, they, when it got closer and closer, they used this measurement to help map out the gravitational well around the sun. Now, they've done this quite a few times now on later missions as the instrumentation gets better and better and better. But this was probably the de facto proof from NASA's point of view in utilizing the Earth and Mars. Something else. Now, Richard kind of talked about this, the precession of the axis of Mercury. So this is kind of a nice little animation of the process. This is, I think Richard called it a corkscrew process as it precessed. Right. Very, very, very accurate, explained a lot of things. And we've actually checked the precession because we've actually noticed that Venus has a bit of precession as well, and we've actually used it to verify that precession. So there was a lot of little bits of data that were very, very confusing based on Newton's time, and Einstein's little theory is explaining these differences that we had discovered. And the question is, what do you do with these field equations? Remember I said very, very difficult, almost impossible back then to solve. Okay. 1916, Karl Schwarzschild. Now, this is amazing. He did this while literally on the front in World War I. And if you can imagine what it was like back then, where you probably heard all your history stories, it wasn't a pleasant place to be. And he received through documentation Einstein's work, and he was the first person to solve this. And he did it by making some very simple assumptions. And with these assumptions, it really made the geometry a lot easier to deal with. And like I said, you're going to have some experience in playing with the Schwarzschild metric. So he was still in the war. So when back then he couldn't internet the solution. They had to type it up, have a courier send it, and then teletype it later on. It made its way to Einstein. And Einstein actually presented it to the Royal Academy of Sciences on Schwarzschild's behalf. And it's sad to say that he died about 4 months later while still on the front during the war. But his solution, very, very simple, changed the way that we look at things. And that's it right there. Now, don't freak out. It's just not a nice little number, but it's not that bad. You kind of look at it, you're seeing terms, you're seeing a term with time, you're seeing a term with angles, and it's a term with R's. It's very similar to that polar equation that I was talking about before. And this equation has a couple of variables that mean something. Now, we'll go into more detail in the notes, but it's going to tell us something about locations, right? And what's very, very important to us is there's a situation here, right, when my location R is the same as my location RS, right? If that's the same as that, RS and R, if they're the same, what does this term in the brackets, what happens to this value of this term in here? Zero, and zero times my time component tells me something. Like time, something happens to zero times time. Something's happening to my time. Uh-oh. What happens, because it's the same component over here, what's happening over here? I'm dividing by 0. And if you try that with your calculator, you get the big E. Something happens. There's a no-no. Something ugly happens in that scenario. Okay? So this is going to be very, very important for us, because it helps us understand as you work through this, it's going to tell us that we have two situations. We have when R equals RS, that equals, if they're the same value, I end up with a divide by 0. But right, if this term also equals 0, something else also occurs. So you're going to see that this equation here tells us a story. It says that in two locations, something strange is going to happen when I divide by 0. Something seems to affect the time, but something also happens when I try to take my dr, divide that by 0, something ugly happens over there. And in mathematics, we don't like dividing by 0. We have to kind of understand what's occurring. Right. Now, I'm just showing you different versions. Again, it's all written down, so don't worry about it. But it's just basically say I'm looking at it in terms of time, but I'm also can look at it in terms of space. Okay? So it's the same type of equation, but this equation tells us what happens when something starts following this path in there. It's just an equation, just like the equation of a circle. Remember that we kind of talked about that? It's like the polar version of the equation of a circle. And it just tells us what happens to certain values when I get closer to certain other locations. And for us, we've noticed that there are two locations that seem to be important where you divide by 0 in this metric. So this is the billiard ball version. This says my object is a perfect sphere. Perfect sphere. It has perfect density. It doesn't change, it doesn't rotate, doesn't vibrate. It just sits there. It's a billiard ball. This is the billiard ball version solution of Einstein's field equation. And when you start plugging in numbers here and start figuring out what happens, the cool stuff starts to come out. So let me just get over here. I just want to jump back here so that it doesn't look too bad. Because we actually calculate this for us. Okay, I've done all this work for you on there, so you don't have to worry about that. It basically says that I have this distance, right? This radius, the Schwarzschild radius, right? That's how far I am from the center that you want to think about it. And if I plug in these numbers, I can determine what the radius is for different objects. This is the location where I start to divide by 0. So what happens for different objects? So if I plug in the mass of an atom and I calculate what the radius is, I get 10 to the minus 51 centimeters. If I plug in a human being, basically, it says if I take the whole mass of a human being and I squash him so that his radius is that size, so I keep you, all of you, but I keep squashing you, what's your radius? What about the Earth? Hang a second. What does that number, I'll get back to you in a second, what does that number remind you of? Yes, didn't Newton use that number? About, was it 9 millimeters, right? So the number using this metric collapsed back to the same value that was done by balancing the two situations to calculate escape velocity. The sun. This basically says if the sun would have a radius of about 3 kilometers. Now, I haven't used the word black hole yet. This is this equation that says, hey, this is the location where I first you end up dividing by zero. The galaxy and the universe, if it was closed, give you an idea. It was a solution. It was a fun solution because nobody knew what to do with it but to play with it. But the solution helped us understand a way of mapping and creating something called embedding diagrams. So it gives us if we use it, at least a visual way of looking at what's happening. So for us, I've emphasized that we're not really using time here. We're looking at specifically from a spatial point of view. But gives us a way of seeing. And when you talk about black holes and people talk about objects or gravity, this is the diagram you always see them drawing. And this is the diagram that only shows you the best way they can do it from a spatial perspective. So always be cautious about that. But if you understand that, it's a kind of a useful little tool. Now, once this was happening, other things were occurring in the world. Now, first thing, I'm going to kick it because I'm going to try to put together a story here. And when the story is done, all these pieces are going to come together to tell us a final picture. So in about 1926, Sir Arthur Eddington produced a great book, the Internal Constitution of Stars. And it basically explained the best knowledge that they had of understanding how a star works, specifically a type of star called a white dwarf, and we'll get into that in a bit. Now, he was one of the earliest proponents of general relativity. Yeah. There are little anecdotes about people saying and talking to him and asking him or telling him that there were only three people that understood general relativity. And Eddington said, well, who's the third? Right? Knowing that himself and Einstein were the experts. Now, in his book and his work, he had a paradox that needed to be resolved. He was trying to understand what happens to stars when they die. His philosophy was that all stars basically end up going through a phase, and they run out of fuel, and they end up collapsing into this object, which he called a white dwarf. All stars, big, small. But he had a little paradox dealing with this, because observational evidence showed that these stars were still radiating. Now, to radiate, the star had to collapse. It collapses, produces more pressure to radiate more heat. But he wanted to stop collapsing. So it had to somehow lock itself into a structure that became stable. Like a rock star. It had to be stable, but then it had to radiate, so it had to collapse. That's the only way he knew how to make it radiate, it was to collapse, but then it had to be stable again. Because all stars of all sizes ended up in this process. And he could not resolve this paradox. Okay. And along comes, now I can never pronounce his name. I always have somebody who's from India who just flows off the tongue. And I'm going to call him Chandra for short. So he was about 19, this is kind of neat. He was actually reading Eddington's book, and he wanted to come to England to study under him. He was a young student, 19 years old, and actually on the boat ride over, he actually partly figured out the solution to this paradox on the way over. So he made his way and got to England, and things worked out, and he got to work with his mentor. Right, so Chandra's mentor was Eddington, and he got to understand, and it was a dream come true. Now, Chandra had many meetings, many talks with Eddington, and at one point, Eddington asked Chandra if he would like to do a presentation to the Royal Society on his work. Now, back then, they did have calculators. It's kind of neat. They had, these are the old cranking type, right? Gears. None of these things you push stuff. These are, and only the best in the world could afford these things. And Eddington, of course, was a sir, and he had one of these things. He actually lent it to Chandra. And every, after Eddington's dinner, he would actually go up to Chandra's workplace and look at what was taking place and seeing how the process, because Eddington was hoping Chandra would help resolve the paradox that he had. And Chandra, in fact, did solve it, but not the way Eddington liked it. Okay? So Eddington, can you imagine, he's looking over the shoulder, kind of knows what's happening, kind of knows where the mistakes are, where there's some not quite concrete evidence inside there. So Chandra's invited to the Royal Society to do a presentation. Now, this is a big thing. Could you imagine doing your, it's like you guys doing a presentation, and Richard's your mentor, and Richard's sitting there proud of you, sitting in the audience as you do your presentation to your peers. So you get up there, you do your wonderful presentation, right? And it's amazing, because what Chandra showed was that not all stars end up where Eddington said they were supposed to end up with. So he uses general relativity and quantum mechanics to demonstrate some interesting old properties. And he gives this wonderful, eloquent presentation. There's some nice applause. You sit down, or you stand there probably waiting for people to ask some very intelligent questions. And then Richard gets up and says, "Oh, that was nice, but I'm going to spend the next half an hour and demonstrate why everything you said was absolutely wrong."
I would do that to you guys.
No. He's not in Eddington. So you could imagine how crushed you would feel. So he actually left the field, right? And back then, you're all eminent physicists listening to this young man do his presentation. And you listen to Arthur Eddington doing his talk to show why this presentation was wrong. And you have to believe somebody. So of course, they all went to Eddington's side initially. But as the years progressed, as people started to understand the mathematics and had time to digest it, they realized that Chandra was in fact correct. And as he said, he received for his work in 1983 the Nobel Prize. And of course, there's a telescope, the Chandra telescope, named after him. Very important to understand this. There's a lot of history. Sometimes it's good, bad, and ugly in the direction I'm going to take you. So, let's piece what we've got here. We've got the work done by Einstein producing these strange equations. Then we just have Schwarzschild that says, "Hey, I've got a nice, interesting way of working with it simply, relatively simply." And then I've got this guy by the name of Chandra who says, "Hey, look, I understand something about the direction that stars have. Certain sizes, they collapse and produce white dwarfs, but there are other sizes to go with." So Richard, you'll have to keep an eye on the time for me so we have a break. So maybe in 10 minutes? 10 minutes, so perfect. Two other guys, Walter and Fritz. Spend a lot of time dealing and working with supernova, specifically the end results. And they basically put together and defined another mathematical object, right, made out of neutrons, where it was compressed enough so that we actually had an object that itself was composed of these neutrons. The pressure of the star was so intense that the cores of the atom itself were actually popped out, the electrons, and the poor little protons themselves were popped out, and some of the electrons were recombined with the protons. A lot of cool stuff was happening inside there. with the amount of density and pressure that was applied to this. And they believed that it was based solely on a phenomenon which we call supernova. Now, if you remember, a lot of these guys based this stuff all on mathematics and intuition. There was no verification yet. Okay? We just got these little snippets saying, okay, this size star will produce this object has this properties. This event on this size star is a supernova will produce this object with some properties. Hasn't been verified. These are all mathematical objects defined initially by simple observation, but a lot with the tool of mathematics to play with. Oppenheimer. Now, everybody hears about Oppenheimer, and they think he's related to the bomb. Well, he does have a tie-in with that, but he was one of the first people to deal and propose the next step. So we have white dwarf, we have neutron star, and then he didn't coin the phrase, but he said there was another object. He actually started putting these certain size limits. Now, Oppenheimer was a very intelligent man, and there was a lot of pressure for him to get involved in the US military. In fact, that's what happens to the scientists during the war. There's a lot of pressure for them to get involved in the military to produce something bigger and better. And part of the reasoning for him to be involved with the atomic bomb was that he knew that no university had the money to afford the equipment to test some of the hypotheses that physicists were trying to understand how a star works. And if you understand how a star works, you can build a bomb based on how the star works. And his philosophy was that if I can do this, at least I've got information that I could not get otherwise, because we certainly do not have any computer back then and do not have the money to do this. So he got involved in that, but for sure came up with the understanding of this next step beyond a neutron star. Now, he had a major battle with Wheeler. Remember? By the way, just to show you how close we are, this is the same Wheeler that this book is named after. This is the same Wheeler that just died a couple of months ago. Had a major battle with Wheeler on what was happening here. Okay, so Oppenheimer said that we do have this object, right, and it does have a mass limit. And it's kind of interesting when Oppenheimer produced his paper, right? And literally a year later, Einstein wrote another paper about his concerns about Oppenheimer's paper and about using the Schwarzschild metric. Remember, that was the tool they were using, the Schwarzschild metric, right? And it was kind of interesting. Einstein made a couple of these little blunders every now and then that he didn't understand his own work. A couple little mistakes here and there. But he wrote this nice little paper to sit there and say, I do not believe in these objects called black holes. In fact, this Schwarzschild metric is just a billiard ball solution, not a real solution. There's no such thing as an object that doesn't rotate or just stays there, has zero properties besides being spherical. Meanwhile, like a series, over in the Soviet Union, there was a great name, Yakov Zeldovich. If you have a right name, that's a great Russian name to have. He was the counterpart to Oppenheimer, okay? Understanding and got involved with their version of the bomb, but also get involved with understanding how stars work. And he actually ended up creating it in 1962. You see how the years are getting closer and closer? We're into your parents' time. Created a great black hole research team and spent some time understanding how black holes power these other objects called quasars. So what was happening in the United States was also happening behind the Iron Curtain as well. Now, what was happening behind the Iron Curtain was a lot more difficult to get out. Information can come in, but it can't go out. It wasn't perfect. The He also thought that volcanic eruptions were due to atomic explosions taking place on the ground, but that happens. But he did do something really wonderful, nuclear chain reactions, right? So again, understanding the process of stars. But the thermonuclear reactions, as in atomic bombs. Yeah, that's what he thought, right? Now, John Wheeler, remember what I said before, he had a bit of a disagreement with Oppenheimer. But then, like any scientist, start to understand, if you can have a disagreement, but you have to understand what you're talking about. So he spent more time working with general relativity until he really understood it, and then realized that Oppenheimer was correct. Now, he actually apologized to Oppenheimer, but Oppenheimer by then had been ostracized so much that he kind of went wacko a bit. So he wasn't quite the same. He's the gentleman who coined a couple of phrases that you may have heard. Right, he published it in actually one of these seminars, and it was published. He coined the phrase black hole, and he also coined the phrase black hole has no hair, which will make more sense as we get along. So, yep. Go ahead.
Teller, and it was more than just his argument about the black holes that were causing problems for him. Yeah.
But he at the time, you have to remember, he had so much involvement with the bomb, and that was always brought up. And he had done so much and then not being respected. So yeah, there was a lot more things. Again, it's probably the best is, you know, as somebody says, to pick up and do some reading. Now, there was a lot of, if we just use the normal geometry that was produced, there was a lot of problems with trying to create a star to become this solid object. Because remember, the mathematics of the Schwarzschild metric basically says it's a perfectly spherical object, no rotations and all this other stuff. And we know stars on rotate and have other dynamics involved and not perfectly homogeneous. And there was a lot of little problems dealing with that. It was Roger Penrose that approached it from a point of view of topology. Okay? How things what stays the same is an object goes from continuously from one shape to the next. Like you see here, I've got a little a coffee cup, right, is topologically identical to a donut. And it's probably why they sell donuts at coffee shops, I guess. I don't understand that, but it's really, really, really wonderful. So he defined the rules from a topological point of view, and in doing so, resolved a lot of problems. And in doing, probably the most important was this point right here. From a topology point of view, that they said that all black holes must have this something called a singularity, whatever that is, at its center. And then there was a whole bunch of other, I'll stop this a little bit. A whole bunch of other people here who've put in 2 cents that have tweaked. So we have Hawking, we have Bekenstein, Kip Thorne, Wall, Susskind, Bern Israel. A lot of these people have put in and tweaked our knowledge of these strange objects. And so when we come back from the break, I'm going to put all what they've discovered in a nice sequence and to show you what we have today. So go and have a break.